The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
And now, Sports Talk 1240.
Well, good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to Hour 1 of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 24th day of May, after which I'll hand it off to Jason Nazario for Hour number 2. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is across the way. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in the former heavyweight champion of the world, the Easton Assassin. Larry Holmes will join us. In the second half, we'll talk to former Major League catcher Charlie O'Brien, who caught 13 Cy Young Award winners during his career, and we'll discuss his new book, The Cy Young Catcher. So sit back and relax and enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on WGBB. We've got some great talk ahead in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page, cleverly titled Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look, and then you can give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter, at SportsTalk1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at SportsTalk1240.com. Well, hey, all of you daily sports players out there, sports fantasy players, Sports Talk 1240 has teamed up with a new daily sports website called DraftPots.com. Go over and register with the promo code SportsTalk1240 and receive a free $5 credit to get you started. Daily fantasy sports players, go check that out at DraftPots.com. Well, my first guest was the WBC heavyweight champion from 1978 to 1983, the ring heavyweight champion from 1980 to 1985, and the IBF heavyweight champion from 83 to 85. He made 20 successful title defenses, placing him third all-time behind only Joe Louis's 25 and Vladimir Klitschko's 22. He's frequently ranked as one of the greatest heavyweights of all time. He's been inducted into the International Boxing Hall of Fame and the World Boxing Hall of Fame. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight the Easton Assassin himself, Larry Holmes. Larry, good evening.
Hey, good evening. How are you doing today?
Great. It's great to have you with us, Larry. Now, you were
Thank
born,
you for having me.
You were born down in Cuthbert, Georgia. You grew up in Easton. To help support your family, you dropped out of school in the seventh grade. Tell us about growing up in Easton.
Well, you know, Easton is just, you know, it's a small town, still a small town. We got about 26,000 people here.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was growing up, we had jobs like steel mills and stuff like that. And now we don't have those. So if I was coming up now, I probably wouldn't have a job because I was able to lie my age and go to the, one of those steel factories and get a job. And that's what I did. And then I, you know, of course, I was doing this PAL thing with the Police Athletic League, and that was in the boxing. And that's what got me going.
And you were able to support your family that way?
Yeah. I was able to give them a little bit of the money because, remember, I wasn't making money. People thought I was making a lot of money.
Right.
But when my first fight was $73, and everybody thought I made $1,000,003.
Yeah, exactly.
That was a long way from that. But you know what? We satisfied. They didn't know. We didn't tell them. And I was satisfied doing what I was doing because I know you got to take one step before you take another one.
Exactly. Now, your amateur career, you were in the Olympic trials. People may not know that. Back in the the Munich Olympics, you were 19 mm-hmm. years old when you started. You boxed, people may remember, Dwayne Bobick, who went to the mm-hmm. 72 Olympic trials. Talk a little bit about those Olympic trials when you boxed Bobick.
Well, I tell you the truth, I didn't want to go to the Olympics because I just had a bad feeling about going over to Munich, Germany, and represent the Olympics. So I didn't really put all my good – I didn't put my effort to any use. I didn't put no effort into beating Dwayne Bobick.
Okay.
So, you know, when I got a chance to get disqualified, I took it. Referee said, if you clinch, I'm going to disqualify you. Well, you know, that was a way out for me. I clinched, I got disqualified, and then after that, the rest is history, you know, because I turned pro right after that and went into the pro game. I never lost again. I became the heavyweight champion of the world 5 years later.
Sure. People may remember Bobick went on to the in that Olympic Games. He got destroyed by Teofilo Stevenson. in the gold medal match. Boy, did he take a beating from Stevenson.
He did take a beating, you know, because he was not a quick fighter. He was ordinary, and he was strong. You know, I got to give him the credit. It was strong. And I think it was in the Navy or Army or something. And, you know, those military guys, they came to fight. And Bobby, he came to fight. He had about 70 fights when he fought me.
Yeah.
So, you know, he had a lot of boxing experience. And I was hoping that, you know, he did win because, you know, I'm American. I wanted him to beat Stevenson.
Sure.
But it didn't come out that way.
Well, we're speaking to the champ Larry Holmes tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now, early in your career, you worked as a sparring partner for guys like Muhammad Ali, Frazier, Ernie Shavers, Jimmy Young. You learned a lot, but that really taught you, hey, I guess if you can hold your own against these guys, what else could you do, right?
Yeah, and I was young then. I was like 3, 4, 5 years younger than them guys, and, you know, if I was doing pretty good, they were knocking me out or beating me up in the gym. I mean, you know, so I said, they're not doing that to me. Now, what I'm going to do? What am I going to be like when I finish and when I learn all I need to learn about how to become a boxer? So, you know, that made me, I dedicated myself even more so that I know if I can work with Muhammad Ali, I mean, it's a dream, you know, whoever gets a chance, you know, at my young age to say that I was working with one of the greatest fighters in the world.
Right.
And it put me on a different level.
Mm-hmm. Now, you first gained credibility as a contender when you upset Ernie Shavers in 1978. Talk a little bit about that first fight against Ernie Shavers.
I knew Ernie Shavers pretty good because I was working with him as a sparring partner. Don King hired me to work with him as a sparring partner. And then one of the things I didn't know about Ernie, that he can't punch. He knocked the heck out of you. If he hit you, he hurts you. And I learned how to stay away from him. And that's what I wanted to do. I knew I could beat him boxing. I knew that. Because he was a guy that plots and everything else, and I knew I could beat him in boxing. That's what I did. I boxed him. I boxed him that first fight. And the second fight, the same thing initially. I boxed him after I became the champion. But if I didn't beat Ernie Shavers, I would have never got a shot at Kenny Norton for the title.
Right. That's what we're going to next. That victory over Shavers set up the title shot between Larry and who was then the WBC heavyweight champion, Ken Norton. That was in Vegas on June 9th, 1978. That was a tough fight, wasn't it, Larry?
Oh, Kenny Norton was a real – I mean, listen, it was life and death.
You know?
I mean, they say I won by 1 point. I thought I won by a little bit more than that, but I take the 1 point because that made me the champion. But Kenny Norton, he was bitter just as he became champion, and he did not want to lose his title, especially a guy like Larry Holmes. And we put 15 rounds of fighting, which they don't do today. I mean, we fought. I mean, toe to toe, side to side, whatever we had to do, we did it. But you don't see these kind of fights anymore.
No, yeah, that was you won the 15th round on two scorecards, and I think it was a split decision that fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, split decision. And listen, they said you barely won. I said, but I won. That's all that matters.
Exactly. Yeah, we're speaking with Larry Holmes about that title fight against Kenny Norton. Now, the third defense was another tough one. That was June 22nd, 79. You faced Mike Weaver. I think he was lightly regarded going into that fight. He only had a 19-8 record. But talk about that fight against Mike Weaver, Larry.
Yeah, Mike Weaver was very tough, you know, very awkward. Nobody gave him a chance against me, but I wasn't really 100% ready for that fight because I came down with some cold in there. But you know what? I was not going to call the fight off because, you know what, I was getting $400,000 for the fight, and, you know, I ain't never seen money like that, so I'm going to take the fight.
Yeah.
So I went on out there, and I did what I had to do, and I won it. I won the fight, but Mike Weaver was tough.
Yeah, tough guy. Nobody gave him the credit that he deserved, though.
Well, that's the way people are. They don't never want to give you credit that you do. Like, for instance, when I fought Jerry Cooney, he was big, strong, knocking everybody out. But when I beat him, they try to take his credit away from him like he was not. And Jerry Cooney was a tough fighter, and I tell everybody that.
We'll get to Cooney. Yeah, I'm going to ask you about Cooney in a little bit. Yeah, we'll get to Jerry.
Okay.
Three months later. After that Mike Weaver fight, Larry, you had your rematch with Ernie Shavers. Now he got a title shot by knocking out Kenny Norton. Now you dominated the first six rounds, but then Ernie sent you down. But then you got up. Talk a little bit about that second fight with Ernie Shavers.
That second fight with Ernie Shavers, I tell you, you know, I was beating him with the jab, his eyes were bleeding, his mouth was bleeding. I said, Ernie, don't take no more of this. He's going to knock you out. I said, Ernie, don't take no more of this punches, man. And I went to hit him with a right uppercut, and he threw his right hand, and next thing you know, I was down. And the referee was standing over me, counting me out. And, you know, I had enough to get up, and then I completed that round, and then I went to work on Ernie Shavers. But, you know, I told everybody, and I tell everybody, this seemed like lightning struck me. That's how hard Ernie Shavers hit me. The hardest puncher that I ever fought.
Tough guy.
Tough guy.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the champ, Muhammad Ali, now. October 2nd, 1980, Caesars Palace in Las Vegas. You defended the title against Ali. He came out of retirement. He wanted to become the first four-time heavyweight champ. Now, you dominated that fight from start to finish. You won every round on every scorecard. Angelo Dundee comes out in the 10th round to stop the fight. Talk a little bit about that fight with Muhammad Ali, Larry.
Well, you know, I knew Ali. I worked with him as a sparring partner. I traveled with him, and I knew exactly what he could do and what he couldn't do. And I told him that, you know, his mind to make a date, his body can't keep, he cannot whoop me. But you know what? He had a lot of pride in his stuff and what he was doing. So, you know, they put the fight together. If I didn't take the fight, they'd say, well, I was scared. And of course, I wasn't afraid. But, you know, Ali could fight, but he couldn't fight me because I knew everything he could do. Every move he would make, I know about that move that he makes. And it was just a matter of time for me to get him. And I kept telling the referee, to stop the fight, stop the fight. Don't let this man continue to take punches.
Right.
But you know how that goes. You know, these referees, they do what they want to do. And finally, Angelo Dundee got in the middle of the ring and stopped the fight.
Now Muhammad, he blamed his poor performance on some thyroid meds that he'd been taking to help him lose some weight. And it left him kind of drained from the fight. Did you know about that?
Yeah, I knew about that. I heard that afterwards, too. But you know what? We all make excuses and stuff like that. Or we all find a reason why we not doing what we're supposed to do. Like, now, I don't believe that Pacquiao had a bad back or bad shoulder or bad arm. I don't believe in a rotator cuff. I don't believe that.
I think
he fought the fight that he tried to fight. And
And then he just lost.
Beat.
Yeah.
Beat,
yeah.
You know? Oh.
But how does that Ali fight go down in your memory, though?
Well, you know, it was a good fight for me because I was winning. I think he might have hit me two or three times on arms. He didn't really have a whole lot, and I knew he didn't have a whole lot because I was beating him up in the gym when I was a sparring partner.
Yeah.
But I had to, you know, do what I had to do, you know? But Ali was my friend and the guy that gave me a job, gave me an opportunity. And I didn't want to, you know, do what I had to do. But, you know, it's a game of boxing. We got to do what we got to do if we want to stay on top, you know. But he was a great guy. He tried, but he had nothing left.
Exactly.
Because I knew everything he was going to do. After I boxed with him for 4 years, I know what he's going to do and how he do it.
Exactly. We're speaking to Larry Holmes tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now we'll get to the great White Hope himself, a local boy from Long Island here, Jerry Cooney. It was July 11th, 1982. You defended your title against Jerry. He was the undefeated number one contender, the big Irish-American boy from Huntington. The lead up to the fight seemed to have a lot of racial overtones, Jerry. They said if he wasn't white, he wouldn't be getting the same purse as Larry Holmes. Talk a little bit about.
You know what?
Yeah.
That's okay too, but you know what? I wouldn't be making the money I made either if he wasn't white. You know, I mean that's what boxing is all about.
So it goes both ways. Is that what you mean? It goes both ways. You mean?
Yeah. Goes both ways, man. You know, if I wasn't who I were and Jerry wasn't who he was, and by him being white, we got that money.
Right.
I would have liked to fought Jerry Cooney 10 times.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, you know, I welcome his color and the people that were following him because and wanting him to win because that created more interest. That's just like the Pacquiao Mayweather fight. We don't want to keep hopping on that, but if the people didn't want to see that fight, they wouldn't have made $180 million. So we need people to watch it and cheer for it.
Did you know, I had read doing some research, Larry, that Reagan had a phone installed in Cooney's dressing room so he could call him if he won the fight. Did you hear that?
Yes, I heard it. But, yeah. You know, I can't say that to be true because I don't really know. But, yes, I heard it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wonder why they did that. You know, yeah. Why would he would do that, you know, with Jerry Cooney? He should do it with both of them. I mean, he's the president. He's supposed to be smart to be president. You don't get to be president being stupid.
Yeah.
And as far as I'm concerned, that was a stupid move if he did that.
That's a little,
you know, so
that's a little over the top. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But, You dropped him in the second round. Jerry came back in the next two rounds, but he hit you pretty hard, didn't he, Jerry?
Jerry could punch, and I told everybody this. Jerry is the second person that ever hit me hard, Arnie Schaefer than Jerry Cooney, because Jerry Cooney could punch. And I told Jerry in that one round, third or fourth round, I don't remember exactly, but he hit me when the bell went ding, and I walked back to the corner with my ribs hurting. And Jerry didn't have no idea that he hit me that hard or hurt me. And I'm kind of glad it didn't because, you know, it gave me a chance to recuperate. And I came back and did what I had to do.
Yeah.
And I tell him that all the time.
Now you guys sort of earned respect from each other in that fight through the length of that fight and through the blows that exchanged.
Oh, we got a lot of respect for each other. You know, matter of fact, you're going to be down here to my golf tournament come July. And my own golf tournament, my wife is putting together because they were trying to do a fundraiser to build a statue. And she's trying to do that. And Jerry Cooney is a big part of that.
So you guys are close friends. You guys are close friends now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very close. I call him all the time. I call him. When I don't have nothing to do, I call Jerry and I say, man, what are you doing?
It's funny how things work out. We're speaking to Larry Holmes tonight. Now, let's talk about Spinks. It's funny how Spinks comes in a light heavyweight and gives you such a hard time. September 21st, 1985, you lost the title. It was a close 15-round unanimous decision to Michael Spinks. He became the first reigning world light heavyweight champion to win.
Mm-hmm.
If you won, you would have tied Marciano's record. After which you said Marciano couldn't carry your jock strap. Talk a little bit about that, Larry.
That fight that I didn't really want. I didn't want that fight, and I probably didn't work as hard as I would normally work because I didn't want the pressure. The pressure was on me too much. Every time I turn around, the record of Marciano, brothers and sisters and family are there sitting in ringside wishing me the bad luck. I mean, you know, I didn't want that. I didn't want to be in that position. I don't want to be in the hate you position.
Yeah.
And they put me in the hate you position because I was fighting a legend. How can you beat a legend? You can't beat a legend. You can't beat a people's person. And that's what he was. So, you know, I wanted to get out of that position. And I didn't want to lose, even though I thought it could have been a draw the first fight. And the second fight, I know I definitely won. But, you know, they seen it the way they seen it, and they took it away from, you know, I'm not bitter. I'm not mad. I'm just glad it's all over. And every now and then, you and I get to talk about it.
Yeah. So you just as soon forget about those Spinks fights.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I hear you. Speaking of Larry Holmes tonight now, how about the Tyson fight, Larry? That you came out of retirement. The money wasn't bad, I'm sure. So they brought you out of retirement to fight Iron Mike. Talk a little bit about Tyson in the ring.
Well, I tell you what, I had quit. I had laid off for 2 years. I got a band, put a band together. I was running around singing, and we were doing okay, stuff like that. One day, I was sitting in the house, me and my wife watching TV. A knock came on the door. Bang, bang, bang. Bang, bang. Who the hell knocking on the door this time of night? And I would come to the door. There was a guy named Don King. Look at that. Don, what the hell are you doing here this time of night? He says, let me talk to you. I said, come on in. I said, what are you doing here? He said, I got to fight for you. I thought I quit. Don't you remember 2 years ago? I quit. He came on in the house, and I said, God, who do you want me to fight? He said, I want you to fight Mike Tyson. I said, oh, shit, hell no. I'm not going to fight Mike Tyson. I've been off for 2 years. He's going to beat me up, knock me out, you know? I said, Don, I can't do it. He said, man, Larry, you got to do it. Here's $3.5 million. I said, I looked at my wife, and I said, okay, let's do it.
Yeah, I guess Mike Tyson. I guess I'd do it too, Larry. Yeah. Why not?
That's how they got me out of there. Yeah, that's what we fight for, money, right?
Yeah. You know? I go in there too. What the heck?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that happened, and then you retired again. Then you come out again to fight Ray Mercer.
Yeah.
And you won that one. He was the undefeated 1988 Olympic gold medalist, so you beat Ray Mercer.
Yeah, because, you know, everybody's saying, I said, look, he's learning how to fight.
Yeah.
He don't know how to fight. He can't beat me. I still got a lot left that you can put him in there, but he can't beat me. And he said, yeah, he'll knock your ass out. I said, okay, fine. Okay, I never thought anything about it. And then next thing you know, they had a contract for me to sign. And then they give me a guarantee to fight. The winner will fight the Vander Holyfield. And I said, well, you know, and I got a chance to make $13 million. I said, well, you know, I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. And I beat Ray Mercer up, and I went to Fort Holyfield. But in the process, before the Ray Mercer fight, in the training, I suffered a detached retina.
Oh, yeah,
so
okay.
I wasn't able to see. And I went in the hospital and everything. He had it all worked. I couldn't really see what I was doing, but I did it good enough to beat Ray Mercer, and that did it good enough to last with Evander Holyfield, which I shouldn't have been fighting. But how can you turn that $12 million? So that's why I did that.
Right.
Everything I did, I had a reason to why I did it.
Exactly.
It was for money.
Yeah.
That's why I did it.
You know? And you still went 12 rounds with Evander Holyfield.
Yes, sir. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Not too bad. Not too bad for an old man, right, Larry?
That's what I say. You know?
Exactly,
but
yeah.
Guess what? Everybody talking about the golden years. Well, they can have the golden years. Give me my youth back.
Yeah. Nah, you did pretty good. How's life in Easton now?
Yeah, it's okay. You know, I'm here. You know, me and my wife and my kids are here. Everybody moved out now because they're all grown and married and have their own kids, but just me and my wife and my two dogs, and, you know, I just got home a second ago when we were talking. I was talking to you on my phone.
Yeah.
It's cool. It's great. It's great. It's great here.
What do you consider your greatest memories in life in the ring?
Becoming a heavyweight champion of the world, man. Mind-boggling. Because there's so many people said to me, that Larry Holmes, your legs are too small. You can punch. You can't beat Muhammad Ali or Kenny Norton or Joe Frazier or Ernie Shaver. You can't do that. You can't beat those guys. You're not going to be nothing. You're not going anywhere. I had sponsors ready to put up money to back me in, and they pulled out when they started hearing all the rumors. And when they pulled out all the rumors, I had nothing but me. And I took me to the heavyweight championship of the world and won that title. And that way, which I shouldn't have said, but I said it anyway, I told you. I said that. I told you I'm going to be the heavyweight champion of the world. And that burned a lot of people. You know?
Yeah.
They didn't like that. So, you know, I regret saying it, but they said bad things to me. You know, so I said, I'm going to be heavyweight champion of the world. And I told you I'm going to be the heavyweight champion of the world. You don't want to believe it? So what? Big deal. And they didn't like me talking to them like that.
And but, no, you know, no, nobody will take that away from you, Larry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No. Who was the toughest? Who was the one single toughest guy, Larry?
Kenny Norton. Kenny Norton was one of the toughest fights that I ever had. Kenny Norton, Ernie Shavers, and Jerry Cooney, and Bernardo Snipes. They were the four fights that I had was really tough. And Bernardo Snipes, because I dropped my hand, and I was going through the motions, getting ready for Jerry. I dropped my hand, and he hit me with that overhand right. But so that's the way that went.
Yeah. Anything you do over?
No, if I can live this life again, I'd do it.
Do the same thing.
You know, I trade this old body in for a new body at any time.
And you do it all the same. Yeah.
Do it all the same. Yep.
Well, that's all anyone can ask, Larry. I'll tell you. It's been an honor and a pleasure talking about your great career in the world of boxing, Larry. I thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night to talk with us on this Memorial Day weekend. And it's been a pleasure, Larry.
Thank you very much. You take care now, anytime.
You take care too, Larry. The great Larry Holmes, ladies and gentlemen. Up next, we'll talk to a great defensive catcher about his new book, The Cy Young Catcher. Charlie O'Brien joins us. Stay with us, folks.
Sports Radio New York and AM 1240 WGBB are proud to announce the new Sports Talk 1240, along with the launch of a brand new website at sportstalk1240.com. Check out our new site for information about upcoming shows, as well as easy access to past shows, articles, our live studio webcam, and more. Of course, be sure to tune in to Sports Talk 1240 every Sunday night from 8 to 10 p.m. on AM 1240 WGBB, or visit sportstalk1240.com for ways to listen to the live broadcast online or from your iPhone. We're excited about these new changes and hope you will be too.
So you're looking for a great club but don't want to go into Manhattan, or you'd like to find a new restaurant to check out, or you're buying a house here on Long Island and you'd like to find out about a certain area. Wouldn't it be nice if you could find out all the information in just one spot? Well, you can. LongIslandExchange.com. It's all you need to find out all about Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com for hotspots, classifieds, news, and more. LongIslandExchange.com is designed with only the Long Islander in mind. Get the best of Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com. Discover Long Island all over again at LongIslandExchange.com.
If you're trying to quit smoking, dipping, or chewing tobacco, you don't have to do it alone. Nicotine Anonymous is a 12-step program of recovery that meets regularly in your area. There are no dues or fees. The only requirement for membership is a desire to be free of nicotine. For information and meetings near you, call 877-TRY-NIC-A. That's 877-TRY-NICA, or visit nicotine-anonymous.org. Let us share our experience, strength, and hope with you.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240. Check us out every Sunday night at 8 p.m. right here on AM 1240 WGBB. And visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Making simple changes in your everyday travel choices makes a big difference to New York's air quality. Trip chain, use mass transit, rideshare, bike, or walk. Visit cleanairny.org to learn more. Clean Air New York, breathe it in. A public service message brought to you by the New York State Department of Transportation.
And now, back to Sports Talk 1240.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you. Happy Memorial Day weekend, when we remember those who served our great nation. Rangers Lightning playing tonight. Last I checked a few moments ago, no score at Madison Square Garden. I unabashedly cheer, go Bolts. Go Tampa Bay. Yes. Go Lightning. Sorry about that, folks. No, I'm not sorry. My next guest was known as a great defensive catcher during his 15-year Major League Baseball career, during which he played for eight clubs. Mainly we remember him for his being with the Mets from 1990 to 1993. He won a World Series with the Atlanta Braves in 1995. His new book is titled The Cy Young Catcher. It chronicles his career receiving 13 Cy Young Award-winning pitchers. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Charlie O'Brien. Charlie, good evening.
How you doing?
Good. It's great to have you with us.
Well, glad to be here.
Well, let's talk a little bit about growing up in Tulsa, Oklahoma. You started catching at age five. Who'd you grow up rooting for, Charlie? Who were your favorite players, favorite teams?
Big Cincinnati Reds fan, just from Johnny Bench, from being a catcher. And he's probably the reason I became a catcher, because, you know, being from Oklahoma, and I wore number five in high school, and you know, I always looked up to him. I love Cincinnati. I mean, Cincinnati was always my favorite team growing up. So, big Red Machine fan.
Yeah, there you go. Nobody better.
No, they were very good. I mean, you know, still, he's one of the best ones ever. So, I got a chance to meet him, you know, when I played. And actually, my son was up for the Johnny Bench Award and got to meet him up there in Wichita, you know, which is given to the best college catchers. So, you know, got to see that. And experience that. So that was a lot of fun for him and myself.
Yeah, that's great. Okay. Now, The Cy Young Catcher is the name of the book. Now, Charlie caught 13 pitchers who were Cy Young winners, three during their Cy Young season. So we'll take a look at some of those great pitchers. Let's talk a little bit about Greg Maddux, certainly one of the all-time greats. Tell us a little bit about Greg Maddux, your experience with him, Charlie.
Well, I mean, just probably the most prolific as far as throwing the ball where he wanted to. He didn't have what you call, you know, dominating stuff, but he had great movement, and he was just his knack for knowing, probably the smartest one as far as knowing what pitch to throw in every situation. He was very, very good about that.
Now,
you know, those are the biggest things that him, you know, that separate him from some of the other ones was his location and his movement.
Now, he analyzed the hitters, really. He's a very, very intelligent guy,
yeah.
Right?
Smartest one. Yeah, smartest one by far. And it all started from him just watching and learning and watching, like, between innings. Just how a guy would warm up, or just, you know, he's always looking for that edge, always looking for that little certain situation that might help him, like how they face guys, you know, the day before or the day after, and always picking up things and remembering certain things.
Give us an example of some things he found, Charlie.
Well, it's just like he'd find out certain guys would sit on certain pitches and certain counts just by, he could tell, you know, I remember him sitting there with Smoltz and said, watch this. If he throws him a fastball, he's going to hit it right over our head. Foul, watch, because he's sitting on a breaking ball. Sure enough, he threw a fastball, and the ball went flying over our head, you know, and I'm sitting there watching Smoltz. And Smoltz is sitting there with his mouth hanging open. He says, how do you know that? I've watched him long enough. I know what he's doing, and I know what's going to happen. If he throws a certain pitch, he's going to hit it. And if he throws a different pitch, you know, he's going to foul it off or be way late on it. So, you know, he really analyzed things, and he actually taught Smoltz how to pay attention to those guys and watch how they, you know, what they did with certain pitches, watch how they fouled them off or hit them hard or took them. You know, he just made them realize that, you know, it wasn't just the game you pitched in. It was the four games, you know, or three games you see before you pitch them, you know, that you learn more about them. You don't learn as much about them when you pitch it to them as the 3 days as you're watching them hit before that. So, you know, the importance of the preparation as far as going into a game and understanding your opponent and what they do best, you know, I think he was one of the best ones at it.
Yeah, so don't be giving hot foots and don't be putting bubble gum on guys' hats and, you know.
Well, he did those kind of things, and he messed with you, but when the game was going on, he'd do it in between innings. You know, he was a mess. He's always doing something funny. I mean, but when the game was going on, he was watching what was happening.
Yeah.
Between innings, that's when he'd get out a little out of control at times.
Okay. Now, what about Leo Mazzoni? Talk about Mazzoni with that staff.
Leo's very good. I mean, Leo, of course, you know, when you have that kind of, you know, those kind of horses in front of you, it's easy to sit and ride them. And that's, you know, he understood to get out of the way. But, you know, he was another guy that, you know, we argued and talked, and we always debated. You know, I call it debating. We'd always talk baseball. Even when I saw him last year, you know, at our alumni deal up there in Atlanta, and I hadn't seen him all those years, you know, we spent 2 hours down in the bar just talking baseball, and it was a lot of fun to me because, you know, he was always asked a lot of questions, always talking, always, you know. Of course, Leo, being the Italian guy he was, really emphasized his point as being the right one, and I would, you know, being a little – the Catholic Irishman, I was going to emphasize my point. So, I mean, it was one of those situations. We really got along well. You know, he had his point of view. I had my point of view, just like all these pitchers, you know. So, you know, the big thing is to understand how you mesh and how it all works. And what Leo did was made sure those guys did all their work in between starts and had them ready to go every time out there.
Sure. Now, one thing I noticed, Charlie, about the book, when you go through the table of contents is – how many of these pitchers have New York ties? And we'll start with one, David Cone. And Cone is familiar to the audience for being with the Yankees and the Mets.
Mm-hmm.
And Coney, when he was with the Mets, had a reputation of being a clown. And also, you know, and you bring out some of the things that he's infamous for. you know, some of the exploits, you know, and we're all too familiar with things like that. But
you know what I don't think you're familiar with is what kind of guy, what a good guy, how much.
Oh no, we're familiar with that too.
You know what I think? He really cared about his teammates. You know, he was one of my favorite teammates because he really cared about, you know, you personally. And that's what I really liked about him. And it was, you know, some teammates will just, you know, you're just a baseball player. And I think he cared about you as a person. And that's what I liked about David. You know, there's a lot of things that went on. I'm sure he wished he could take back. But, you know, those all were part of the process of maturing as a player.
As growing up, yeah. Was going to say,
Sometimes we grew up a little bit later than other people. But I think he was a lot better when he got to the Yankees.
Yeah.
I think he had gone through a lot of growing pains with the Mets. And you know, I think it really things took hold more so. And I think, you know, Joe Torre had a lot to do with that, too. And, and the teammates he had there, I think he realized that, you know, this game can be very fleeting at times. And, you know, if you don't take care of the little things, you know, like slowing down a little bit and not having to go out as much, or, you know, because New York can get you if you don't pay attention to the important things about being prepared to play games and going out there, you know, and pitching every fifth day, you know, it can run you a little ragged.
Right, it'll swallow you up. Ask
exactly.
People like Doc and Strawberry and people like that. But he was a hired gun if there ever was. Him, Wells, people like that.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I enjoyed was the security guard up above the bullpen. I didn't know that one. Yeah, that was a good one, Charlie. I enjoyed that one. Thanks.
Oh yeah, I enjoyed it too. I'd warm him up, and I get to look up there every time he threw that ball up there. So I was like, oh, okay, good.
Yeah, let's continue. Yeah, that was a good one. Yeah. And then we're speaking to Charlie O'Brien tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Frank Viola. Now, Frank was not a flamethrower. Mm-hmm. He had that changeup that was taught to him by Johnny Padres when he was with Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting story that you tell is that he was you were really one of the last guys he spoke to in the game before he walked out of the clubhouse.
Exactly. And it was his last game. He pitched, and I think he got beat in it, but he pitched. I might have got beat 3-2, but he threw very well. And they had a situation where they had to, you know, they had to make a move, and they let Frankie go. And I can remember just like it happened yesterday. You know, we're sitting in the lounge where we eat, and he walked up to me. And he said, "Hey, dude, I got a question to ask you." And he said, "Do you think I'm finished?" I said, "No, I really don't." I said, "You might not throw as hard as you used to, but I still think you can pitch, and you still change speeds, and you still, you know, you have to be more of a control pitcher than probably you were in the past. But no, I don't. I think you ought to keep, you know." He said, "They let me go. Should I keep playing?" I said, "Yeah, I would." You know, and he knew me being me and honest and straight to the point. I said, "Yeah, I'd keep playing if it was me." But I think he decided to hang it up after that. And you know, I got a chance to catch his last game, and unfortunately,
I
never pitched again. But, you know, good memory for me. I was a sad, you know, just to pitch that, you know, like that. And that's kind of way the game, you know, it ends abruptly at times. And sometimes when we, you know, the perfect world is us, you know, being on top of the game whenever you leave. And it usually doesn't work like that. And it's just, you know, it's sad to see someone, you know, that's pretty good buddy of yours go out and get released and, you know, have to carry on with life.
Frank's an example, as with a couple of these guys we'll speak about, of the Mets getting a guy at the wrong time.
Well, that happens if you notice now. I mean, it's always been somewhat that. You know, there's a good deals and bad deals.
Which is classic Mets, getting a guy at the wrong time.
I mean, that, you know, the thing was, you know, they all make decisions. And you know what? I think a lot of people have a tough time playing in New York.
Yeah.
And, you know, it can, you know, if you get caught up into it can swallow you. I mean, I enjoyed my time in New York. It wasn't my favorite place, but you know what? I've met a lot of good people. I mean, there's a lot of friends that I still stay in contact with. And, you know, I enjoyed my time there. You know, I enjoyed the fans there. I thought they were really good fans. Met fans are different than Yankee fans, but, you know, I enjoyed my time. I enjoyed the organization was you know, at that time was run pretty well, I thought. They just, the guys they got didn't really seem like they all played together at one time. You know, it seemed like everyone got hurt or something. You know, it's just our pitching staff, you look at the guys we had there, just didn't really stay healthy. And when you don't, you know, in Atlanta it was much different. Because
yeah.
All those guys went to the post every day. And, you know, it's easy to win when you run five guys like that out there every day and have them every day. And you start taking those, you know, you take Maddox out of there for half a year or 6 months and, you know, have to go win. It's tough to do that for Atlanta.
Well, that's what we're trying to develop now here now, Charlie. But the thing is that they can't hit the side of a barn.
Well, I
that's
mean,
the
it's
problem.
Just like you get the pitcher. But you know what? I love their arms. I really do. I mean,
yeah.
And Sandy Alderson, I was in Oakland when he was there, and I really like him. I think they're on the right path. You know, I think they'll do all right. I think they're going to find some people. Hell, you look at the Yankees; they hit and they don't pitch. So, I mean, what do you? You got to figure. There's got to be a happy medium there somewhere.
Yeah, win. Well, here's another guy who seemed to get swallowed up in New York, and that's Sabes, Brett Saberhagen.
Mm-hmm.
Two-time Cy Young Award winner. Came to the Mets and had his problems. Talk a little bit about Saberhagen, Charlie.
Just, you know, it's one of those things that got caught up in New York, I think, a lot of it. There's a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
You don't understand. It's just like I always go to New York. But New York's different than any place you'll ever play.
Mm-hmm.
You either can handle it or you can't. You know what I mean? You either take it and just, you know, deal with all the other stuff, the side things, and you deal with those and you go on to just, you know, or you don't deal with it very well and it bugs you, you know. Because you almost have to be, your skin has to be hardened when you go to New York because there's so many people that are going to like you and other people are not going to like you. But there's so much media coverage and so many people are engulfed into the media and the radio and all that stuff. And it's, you know, if you sit there and listen and get your feelings hurt, you know, it's not the place to play. I can tell you that. You got to be a man to play in New York. You really do.
Got to have a thick skin. Yep.
Yeah.
For sure.
No doubt about it.
Now,
very knowledgeable people, though. I mean, the media is even way more knowledgeable than a lot of these other places you go.
Every place you turn, you're going to, in the paper,
yeah,
sports radio, there's always somebody that you're going to have to live in a bubble to if you think you're not going to
exactly, but you got to if you just think of New York, oh, I can go to New York and play. Well, let me tell you something. No, you can't. Not everyone can go there and play.
Exactly,
it takes a different kind of player, a different kind of personality to be successful in New York. It really does.
One guy that had some success here, two-time Cy Young Award winner, was Tom Glavine. Now another guy of a great changeup.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about Glavine. He's certainly deserving of the Hall of Fame.
Oh, there's no doubt. Glavine is the most unflappable guy of all of them. You know, he just never gave in. You know, he wouldn't bother him to be, you know, he'll walk a guy if he has to walk them because he didn't ever give in. You know, Tom Glavine had huge pelotas, you know. I mean,
yeah.
He did what he had to do. He did what he wanted to do and not what that hitter wanted him to do, and that's what I liked about it. Anytime you have a good changeup, though, to me, all those guys, really those guys like Maddox had a good changeup, Viola changeup, Glavine had a real good changeup. Those guys dominated the game with a pitch that's, you know, I think is the most underrated pitch in all of baseball because if you throw a good one, you can get out of so many jams. It's a pitch saver.
Yeah.
What it does. It you know, you can, instead of, you know, if someone like Saberhagen and Cone had those things, or Gooden had those early in their careers, they, you know, instead of throwing 140, 145 pitches, they'd throw 100 and do just, and I think their careers would have been longer even.
Definitely, yeah. Glavine, unflappable. I think that's what helped him survive here.
Yeah, and he just had a personality. I mean, nothing seemed to bother him. I mean, he won that World Series game, won the nothing, he never even sweat when he pitched. Him and Maddox, the only two guys I ever see throw games and never sweat. It's the damnedest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
When you play in Atlanta, you know, it's 100 degrees with 100-degree humidity, and it's like you can't even breathe. And those guys just walk off, and their hair's not even wet. And you couldn't figure it out.
Yeah. We're speaking to Charlie O'Brien tonight. Now, here's Roger Clemens, seven-time Cy Young Award winner. You talk about him coming back to Boston. with Toronto. You said you were nervous walking with him. Talk a little bit about Roger Clemens coming back to Boston.
I'm telling you, it was the most unruly I've ever seen people to one person. And we kind of leave there and walk out of the bullpen. And he said, "Hey, LB, stay right here next to me." So if I get shot, he said, "Stay in front of me." So you get hit before I would. And I said, "Hell no, I'm out of here." I took off running after that. I said, "You're on your own, bud." And just, you know, because I knew he was laughing about it. But, man, what a game. I mean, just the atmosphere. It was almost like a World Series game after looking back on it. And how it was so, you know, pro against him. And at the end of the game, you know, and he punched out those last three guys. And I think he had 15 punch-outs or something. And it was just phenomenal, the reception he got going off the field. And he, you know, he kind of looked up at the general manager's box up there and kind of tipped his hat to him. I thought that was the coolest thing in the world.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So you thought, because he, you know, had been told he was done, you know. He was done. He was out of shape. And
he was far from it. Yeah, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, he rolled on since then.
Now, talk about testifying at the trial, Charlie. A lot of people...
Very intimidating.
Yeah.
Very intimidating, because I've never been in any trial in my life, you know. They'd asked me a bunch of questions beforehand. You know, and the weird thing was the government never, even though they knew I was a witness, they never called me and asked me, you know, any questions, which I thought, well, I was one of the very few guys that they, when I found out after that, didn't get questioned by the government. So, you know, I just told them what I had seen. And, you know, it's like, then you get up there and, boy, it's an intimidating experience for me. I mean, it was not, you know, it's like I just didn't. Because they'd ask you a question, and you'd answer it, and they'd ask you the question again and phrase it different. And it's like, well, you know me, it's like, well, I just answered that. He goes, no. I said, you got to answer it. So I said, okay, so I just answered it just like I did before. You know, it's just they keep going back and forth, back and do the same thing over and over again. And it was frustrating to me because it's like, you know, I told you the answer three times now. But they want you somehow to say something that they want you to say, but I guess I didn't really help them. I guess I helped Rod and want to help them.
Yeah. Now,
but very intimidating. It's not something that I'd ever want to do again.
Did you ever see anything happen with Roger as far as?
No. I'm just telling you, I've been around him way too long.
Yeah.
The things that we always, you know, how he's the hardest working dude of any pitcher I've ever played with, you know. Constantly running, constantly working out, constantly doing what it took to be, you know, be ready to play. I mean, like I said, there's balls that I've scuffed up for other guys.
Yeah.
Give them to him. He wouldn't. He said, flip them back. He said, I don't need that shit.
Yeah.
Give me a good one. You know, I'm just like, okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just so, I mean, he could have done it and done all he wanted with it, but he didn't, you know. He just did his thing, man. He's like John Wayne. He didn't need that kind of shit to me.
Yeah. Fair enough. We'll talk about one of the great guys in New York lore. He's going to be our guest coming up this season, the great Doc Gooden. Certainly, I've seen him a few times lately, and it seems like he's doing pretty good. You seem to be a big fan of his, Charlie.
Love Doc Gooden, man. One of my favorite guys to play with.
Yeah.
By far. He took me under his wing. He took care of me from coming from you know, Milwaukee. You know, I played with his nephew Gary Sheffield.
Right.
I mean, I can't. There's nothing. I mean, Doc Gooden could stay with me the rest of his life. I mean, that's what I think of him. And I know, you know, all the things he's gone through. And Doc is such a good dude. He was a Doc wasn't the leader. He was a follower. And that's where I think he got in a big problem with Straw. Straw was the one that stirred the drink over there and caused a lot of problems in Doc's life. And, you know, from I hear, Straw has gotten a lot better from what he was when he was in New York. So, you know, to me, man, that's as good a dude as you'll ever want to meet.
Now, you're quite adamant about the strawberry in the book, too, Charlie. I see him as a teammate, and a lot of people have that opinion of Strawberry as a teammate.
Well, hopefully he's changed. You know, I don't know. I mean, I was with him there for a month, But I'd heard stories ever since then, and I did hear him say, you know, hey, they weren't going to play, they weren't going to pay him. You know, he was going to be a free agent, and they didn't want to renegotiate his contract.
Right.
They don't pay him. They ain't going to pay me. I ain't playing.
Yeah.
His back was hurt. You know, and it, you know, end up getting beat what by a game or two games and by Pittsburgh, and he was the kind of player that made a difference. Where you know, if he'd have played that last month or six weeks, whoever it was, he said his back was hurt. Made a difference, you know. To me, and that's not being a very good teammate.
No, and that leaving New York, I think, was the biggest mistake of his career.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I never was a big fan of his. Anyway, I mean, he's a great player and all, but as a person, you could, I'd take 10 Doc Goodens over someone like that.
Yeah. He, well, both of them wasted their potential, but.
Yeah, probably. I mean, it's just sad because of what happened, but, you know, it's just, you know, it goes to show you that good people get caught up in those drugs, too. And it's not just because you're a bad person to them. There's a lot of good people ruin their lives and ruin their families. And, you know, I don't understand it, but, you know, it happens every day in today's society. And it's just a sad experience, but, man, that's a good dude.
Yeah.
That goodness is, man, you're talking about a good cat.
That was that's a great chapter, and I recommend people who pick up the book Cy Young Catcher to check out that Doc Gooden chapter, because Charlie's got some great things to say about Doc. How about this year's Hall of Fame inductee, Smoltz?
Smoltz was probably the most difficult of all the guys I've had to catch.
He was
probably the most difficult to get him to throw his fastball more. I mean, he had such great stuff. He didn't want to listen, hard-headed, you know, which is kind of a, he talks about later on, you know, they wished they'd have listened sooner, you know, because they understand how important it was with their fastball. But, you know, but he had such good breaking ball, had a good fork ball. He threw those and really dominated that part of it. But, you know, their fastball was really set him apart and pitched off of that instead of throwing more breaking balls. And, you know, he learned later in his career, like a lot of us do, that, you know, you become a better player usually when you get older because your just experience has taught you, you know, more than anything. And I think he understood the importance of his fastball, you know, later in his career when he became a closer and then back to pitching again.
Definitely, yeah. We're speaking with Charlie O'Brien tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Charlie, talk a little bit about the development of the catcher's helmet that you're famous for.
Well, I mean, it's just the reason why I did it, and we talk about it in the book, is, you know, I got tired of getting beat up. I mean, people now, I mean, you see all the concussions that's going on now and how important, you know, headgear are. So, you know, we actually had it tested compared to the other mask, and it was quite a bit safer. You know, the bad thing was getting Major League Baseball to, you know, adhere to it, and they didn't want really to let me use that for almost a year's time to get it, you know, tested. And then we found out that they never tested a regular catcher's mask, but they were going to test mine. It made no sense, you know, and they had no testing for helmets or anything. And I just think, you know, maybe my thing maybe started them looking into, you know what, we might, you know, make some changes with our helmets too. And what it's done is made the game safer. I think a little bit more so than it was when I was, you know, when I first started. So, you know, that's one thing that I'd be proud of. I think that has made the game safer for kids and catchers that are actually playing now. A lot of them haven't done it, but, you know, that's their choice. But I just think, you know, it's been tested. It's way safer as far as absorbing energy than a regular catcher's mask. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the reason why. I didn't do it to let someone else do it. I just did it because I was tired of getting beat up.
Yeah. I mean, umpires are wearing it too.
I mean, people don't realize when you get hit like that, you know, it's like a flash of lightning, and then you don't really know where you're at. It's hard to explain. But then, you know, your instincts take over, and you're kind of doing things, and then you seem like you forget what you did. And it's, you know, it's happened. I don't know how many I had. I know I've had a few, and you get sick to your stomach, and you just don't feel good. And, you know, so it's just. I think it was time for me to do something like that, and that's kind of what I tried to do. And hopefully, it's made you know, my kids wear them and they're safer. And sure, nowadays we're wearing a lot more of them. So hopefully it'll help someone else later down the line.
You wonder if they went through so much testing with Roger Bresnahan's mask, right?
Yeah.
You wonder if they made, yeah, if they said, listen, Roger, we're going to have to test this thing. Gee.
Yeah. It's amazing sometimes. The proper channels.
Yeah. I mean, have you seen the halo that Torres wears for the Mets, the pitcher?
Yeah. I mean, it's just, yeah. I mean, it looks funny, but who cares?
Yeah. I'm surprised more pitchers haven't gone to that.
But I think it's a hard, you know, you just put something on your head and throw with it. It's kind of different.
Yeah.
You feel it right away. It's a lot easier to throw without your catcher's mask on than having it on.
Definitely.
You know, you have to do it, but it's like you'd much rather, if I had a choice, I wouldn't wear anything. You know, if you knew where I never know you hit, it's great to throw without a mask on or a helmet on or anything like that. So.
Sure.
But, you know, it's just that added weight or added something on your head really messes you up. Really does.
What are you up to these days, Charlie?
I'm actually helping watch my kids play baseball. I've got a ranch about 30 miles outside Tulsa. Got a bunch of cows on it, and I have a 8-foot fence around it. I have deer on it. I have deer hunts, you know, in the fall. So stay busy that way. I mean, anyone that's been in ranching knows that you go from one thing to the other, you know, cutting hay to spraying grass to, you know, working your cattle, weaning your calves. I mean, you're doing something all the time as far as in the ranching bit. It just gets you out of the country. I mean, gets you out into the country, and, you know, you're not working behind a desk, and you can make some good money right now with the cattle prices the way they are. So it's just fun. It's just my way that, you know, my dad got me into that when I was younger, and kind of taken and run with it ever since.
Sounds good. Well, Charlie, it's been a pleasure having you with us tonight. The book is called The Cy Young Catcher. And I thank you for being with us tonight, Charlie.
All right, bud. Enjoy. I hope everyone enjoys it.
Thanks, Charlie O'Brien, folks. That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, Larry Holmes and Charlie O'Brien, and you for joining us. Stay tuned for Hour 2 with Jason Nazario up next on Sports Talk 1240. I'll be back with you on Sunday, June 14th. Till then, Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
Expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.